listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician.
Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 64 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin, and joining me for this roundtable edition of the podcast are the usual suspects, Chris and Robert. Hey guys, how you doing?
Fantastic.
Excellent. That's what I like to hear.
It's good raining stuff outside, which means the pollen count is down.
And you can breathe again.
I can breathe.
Oh, I kind of miss the sunshine.
It'll be back for a week or two in the summer. Well, we had some feedback last episode. We were talking about possibly doing some podcast with gear or, you know, musical equipment in mind.
Right, right.
And we had a lot of positive feedback about that. People weighed in via Twitter and email saying they'd love for us to do something like that. So we'll maybe get a few things in the works. I'm not promising anything over the summer, but maybe come fall, we'll see. But and also we've mentioned how there's been a bunch of requests for some podcast segments about us, and I just want to say that we're working on that. Robert here has his own podcast called the Story Life Podcast.
That's
definitely
right,
check it out.
I do.
And I've been talking to him about doing a podcast on us in the same vein as his Story Life Podcast, which would be kind of like This American Life. So if you like that podcast,
only far less interesting because it would be about us.
Because it's about us, right?
Well, his podcast is the episode he does on us. Who knows what it'll be like? But
oh, his podcast is great.
Yeah. So yeah, we're thinking about doing that. And I was just gonna say, if you're interested in seeing some of my musical past, I know people were wondering to hear about some of our past experiences in music. I just uploaded a ton of photos to my Flickr account and spent way too much time writing all about each picture. And it was kind of interesting to go back and look at my musical experiences then and compare them to now. But if you're interested in seeing those, lots of pictures of small town poets and stuff like that and touring. And it's just flickr.com/KevinBruner.
Woohoo!
Well, let's get into some news.
Can you say that a little more excited, with a little more excitement in your voice?
Let's get into some news.
No, more excitement. Come on.
Let's get into some news.
Yeah.
Let's check out the news. Much better.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
Music.
Music. News.
Well, you might have heard by now that Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails has decided to walk away from social media. This was a bit of a surprise, seeing as the Nine Inch Nails frontman had become known for his out-of-the-box thinking on music promotion and the use of social media. Trent linked to a lengthy missive he posted on the Nine Inch Nails forum explaining the thinking behind lowering the curtain on his angsty mystique and making himself more approachable, and the attendant inevitable fallout which has become too distracting and too destructive for him to bear, so he's retiring his Web 2.0 presence. To read all the details, check out the Nine Inch Nails forum. But I did notice when preparing for this podcast that Trent has started Twittering again. I guess it's more addictive than he realized. A replay of the nation's only file-sharing case to go to trial has ended with the same result. A Minnesota woman is found to have violated music copyrights and must pay huge damages to the recording industry. A federal jury ruled Thursday that Jamie Thomas Rassett willfully violated the copyrights on 24 songs and awarded recording companies $1.92 million, or $80,000 per song.
Oh my gosh.
Kara Duckworth, a spokesman for the RIAA, said the industry remains willing to settle. She refused to name a figure, but acknowledged Thomas Rassett had been given the chance to settle for $3,000 to $5,000 earlier in the case. Whoa. As of taping this podcast, there was not word as to whether or not the decision would be appealed. The new iPhone is finally here, and if you're a longtime listener to the podcast, you know that I'm a bit of an iPhone geek. The one thing I want to highlight as it pertains to music promotion opportunities is the new iPhone with its new camera will take will take video and allow you to do basic editing and post those video clips on the web. This should give legs to many Twitter-like video services that allow you to post short videos in a similar fashion to the 140-character posts of Twitter. I'm sure we'll see artists and bands making great use of that feature to provide more of a real-time experience of their music. And
yeah.
With specifically Trent Reznor, the thing I thought was interesting is this highlighted that, you know, the rules for Twitter aren't the same if you're a big established act who's new to social media and already has this mystique about you. It really doesn't serve you well to just break that mystique. I'm not exactly sure what he did. I follow him on Twitter, but apparently he started talking about his love life and all this stuff, and people thought it was goofy or corny, and then he kind of would get into it with some of the fans directly, and it seemed kind of junior high-ish, you know, junior hires fighting on Twitter, and it just seemed like, I don't know, it seemed like he was taking people's comments personally, and someone like that just needs to do what they do and interact, but not get too personal.
Yeah, it seems like he should treat people sort of with kid gloves, since he just, for his own personality and who he is, he automatically has more power, destructive or yes, or otherwise, in the exchange between him and his fans. But I also kind of feel bad for him, because he said when he was pulling his presence from Web 2.0 that, you know, all you people still expect me to be the same tortured guy I was in 1994, and like, I've grown up, like, why do you expect me to, you know, I sort of felt from he felt boxed in by that image he had created for himself, and he couldn't,
you know, he has a presence, a brand, a character, somebody he plays on stage, you know, this leather pants wearing, like, dark, mm-hmm, you know, character that he's created for himself, and that's what people know of him. They don't know anything about his personal life, and that's what, you know, that's what they're looking for, you know. It's
I think with his case though is that his brand hasn't grown with that. I'm not a big Nine Inch Nails fan. I've followed along just because of what's been, you know, they're getting coverage for what he's been doing the last couple of years. But his brand doesn't seem to have morphed out of that angry, you know, character that started back in the 90s. But, you know, part of it, I think, is that, you know, you're an established act and you've got a brand. And so you do have to kind of portray that brand, otherwise people kind of feel like they're just being, it's just a show. And also I think part of it was, to me, following him on Twitter was interesting as a person that's not a fan, but if I was a fan of his music, there would have been a lot of times I would have been offended. Like, he would cuss out the crowd because he didn't think they were very good, you know, you guys sucked, I hated you. And, you know, if I was a fan that was just at that show reading that on Twitter, I'd be kind of like, well, screw you. You know, yeah, I just paid to come to this show.
Yeah.
So he did a lot of that I thought, you know, eventually that's going to bite you. You're totally a public figure, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
There are, you know, you can say what you want, but there are consequences for what you say.
Yeah. And when you're someone of that stature and you say anything, there's the consequence, there's the potential consequence that you're changing a fan's perspective. Like, when Trent Reznor's talking about his crowd, it reminded me, the first time I ever saw Radiohead was like this magical experience. I loved it. I thought it was amazing. The best show I'd ever seen. Then I read online the next day that Johnny, the guitar player, said it was their worst show of the tour. And I was like, oh. And it shouldn't have colored my experience, but it kind of did.
Yeah.
So maybe he should have just kept his mouth shut.
The RIAA lawsuit. I still can't figure out if the jury awarded that enormous out-of-control settlement just to almost make it ridiculously huge that it would get thrown out, because sometimes that can happen if the settlement's just totally not way beyond.
Well, it's just, she's a single mother, right?
No, she's married. She's got three kids. She might have been single when this first started, because I thought if it's the same person.
Either way, I'm sure they don't have the money to pay that settlement.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like, this whole thing is just a charade. All they're going to do, I mean, you could file bankruptcy, it's gone. You know, I mean, that's basically what a lot of companies do when they get sued for billions of dollars in a class action lawsuit. They just go out of business, and that no one got any money, and it was just a big waste. So the RIAA is just trying to make
a giant
scene out of somebody, because if they're willing to settle for $3,000, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
That's per song.
It didn't say per song in the article I read, but it may have been,
I think,
per
it's
song.
Per song. I thought it was $3,000 to $5,000 per song, and she was being sued for 40 songs?
24.
Oh, 24, okay.
But still, regardless, they've spent 10 times that amount on lawyers.
Right.
And it's like, they're not going to get their money. It's a huge negative PR thing. The artists who they're suing on their behalf are not going to see a penny of this. So it's just, it's a lose-lose situation all the way around.
You know what? Downloading a song illegally is like stealing a candy bar. It's worth about, in my mind, it's worth about 50 cents, you know? Like,
She was linked up to a file sharing site, I think. So aren't they going after her because technically people were taking that song
infinite amount of times from her computer? The thing that's a little bit scary about the decision, they had no proof that anybody had taken anything. They just know that she, by having this software on her computer, was making all these tracks available. Now, through the service, they don't track that stuff. So it wasn't like she was using Kazaa. It wasn't like they went and subpoenaed their records and they saw, okay, here's all the times those transactions took place. They just said those tracks are available, and then they themselves went out and through a third-party agency and obtained some tracks off her computer. So there was no proof that it was happening, but just that they were made available. And that's where some people get really upset about some of the unclarity in the law, because right now, technically, if you were making tracks available, you are the same as sharing them. Hmm. It's pretty crazy. So
I'm all for paying for music, but that is just ridiculously criminal on the part of the
RIAA. Plus, it's like there's no way, the average person is not savvy enough technology-wise, even if they're not doing anything wrong, to cover themselves in some of those, and to put safeguards in place to make sure.
Yeah.
The only safeguard really is to not have music on your computer at all.
Right.
Because you don't know of what programs. I mean, iTunes could open up a big window and I not know it. And
or if you're using Bluetooth and someone right next to you in a coffee shop is using Bluetooth, they could just go on your computer and grab your music files, right?
Technically, probably so. Somebody that goes by Bish Music on Twitter and just asked if we had any thoughts on this week's file sharing decision. So,
oh, we just had some.
So there they are. So yes, we did. All right. Well, let's move on to happier topics. So last episode, we talked. The stupid light is in my way.
you're being strangled by
I'm
a
like
lamp.
Right in the corner. I think it might be time for me to ask for CD Baby to buy another microphone stand, so I don't have to wedge myself in the corner with this.
At least we have electricity this
That's
time.
That's true. We do have electricity this time. I guess we could be thankful for that. But last week's episode of the podcast was Bruce Houghton from Hypebot, and Bruce was a very nice guy and very informative. We're not going to talk much about Hypebot today because we have another topic we wanted to discuss, but I did want to mention that Hypebot is definitely one of my favorite blogs. I look at a lot on a daily basis, not as many as Bruce does. He said he looks at like 120 a day.
Wow, yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
And that'll fry your brain, let me tell you. So Hypebot's a good one if you're just wanting to stay up to date with a few blogs that seem to be on the cutting edge, the pulse of you know what's coming in music and promotional opportunities. Bruce has a good balance between you know the indie artist and the indie artist experience and you know the bigger industry at large. And
yeah, and you just read Hypebot and you don't have to look at 120 blogs because he's already narrowed it down to the most important
stuff.
That's
right. And you know what? He normally does have the most important stuff there. So it's a good blog to check out. And he had some great advice on if you're an artist, you know, looking for a booking agent and booking shows and things like that. So if you haven't heard that episode, it was episode number 63. I highly recommend it. But right now we're going to discuss a little bit of about Twitter and some of the evolutions of Twitter, because you probably have noticed lately that Twitter is everywhere.
Have you noticed that we talk about Twitter quite a bit as well?
Hey,
have you
stopped talking about music?
Have you noticed that we were talking about it long before Oprah and other people? I think she listens to the podcast. Anyway, it's everywhere on the news, everywhere you go. I can't remember where I was walking down the street yesterday and there was like a sandwich board with, you know, like the restaurant and we're on Twitter, you know, it's like everywhere.
I get my Twitter updates in the shower.
That's a good place to get them. But because of that, it's also, I think, drastically changed a lot since we started talking about it on this podcast.
Yeah.
And for the good and for the bad, But we will post a link to this video that Chris over here was passing around earlier. Mm-hmm. And if you can pause the podcast now and watch it, it'll be in the show notes of the podcast, and then you can pick up on the conversation. But Chris, tell us a little bit about the video.
Okay, so this Rolling Stone music critic, Christopher Weingarten, that's yeah. his last name, right?
Actually, I've got, did you have the title of the video? I've got the title of
the
video.
What is it called?
It's called The Death of Music Criticism and How to Ensure Your Own Inevitable Demise in 140 Characters or Less. Crowdsourcing Killed Punk Rock by Chris Weingarten. All right, so go ahead.
So he is invited to be a guest speaker at a new social media conference or convention. Twitter conference, okay. And he gets up there and he does this really charismatic, feisty, fiery rant about basically how his job as a professional gatekeeper, as a professional music critic, is being destroyed by Twitter, you know, and blogging and all this stuff. And he goes through the evolution of the destruction of traditional music criticism from, you know, when the internet first comes on the scene, websites like Pitchfork start taking the place of Spin Magazine and Rolling Stone.
Right.
Then the blogosphere explodes, and that takes some of the power away from websites like Pitchfork.
Right.
Now, finally, Twitter is available to everyone immediately, quickly, so that's taking power away from the blogosphere. But he caught a lot of flack for this, and people were basically saying he was an old dinosaur. But I kind of agree with most of his points, which to me it didn't seem like he was giving himself a pity party. It seemed like he was more saying, this is great, Twitter is available to everyone, and now everyone can be a valid music critic as long as you're telling people why they should or should not like something. And in his view, he was seeing this new Twitter trend as like just narcissism gone awry. Everyone's saying, oh, I love this music, I'm at this concert, I'm having so much fun, blah, 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 but not getting to the point of why you should or shouldn't like something. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think part of it is the clash of, well, partly the explosion of Twitter that's happened has forced this like sudden evolution on it that some people are aware of and some people aren't, where you have people that still use it like their status updates, because that's originally how it started, as just basically the status update out of Facebook. But then users started using it differently than that and did tweaks like being able to reply to people and things like that. So you have people that are really like, I like this, I'm listening to this, I'm doing this. But then with its growth and popularity, there's other people that saw it as like microblogging, which is what I tend to like to use it as or see it as. And also that the information is real and now, and you know, we're seeing that with like this whole thing in Iran right now. It's like Twitter's the way anyone's getting news out of there, because right. everything else has been shut down. But they can't stop Twitter. I think his ultimate point is there's some filters that are now gone that sometimes are good filters for people who are really trying to find good things.
And also, I think he was just displaying a disgust and a fear that these tools that we now have are enabling our worst narcissistic tendencies rather than adding to any kind of intelligent discussion about music. Or like he said, we're not being challenged to sit through anything that we might not like at first glance. So you're not being exposed to anything that's going to challenge you and that maybe you'll end up loving. We're basically just going after the things that we already feel comfortable with. So indie rock hipsters are just perpetuating their own little thing, and hip hop people are only perpetuating their thing. You know what I mean?
I don't know. I mean, I liked his personality. I like some of the things he had to say, but I think for the most part, he's just kind of whining because things are changing. And I think that the thing that's not going to go away is that good content is still valuable. It might not be as valuable as it was before, but like, you can't break a band anymore. You can't be the one who tells everybody about the band because they've already heard about it before, because information is going so quick. So you're not the gatekeeper anymore as far as writing for Rolling Stone. You're not breaking any new information to anybody, and I'm sure he bemoans that. But like, if you write a really good article about music, you know, a dynamic, interesting article, like that still has value to magazines, has value to blogs. like it has, you know, that writing ability still has value because, yeah, people, you know, I don't know. I don't want to read like a whole bunch of 140 word snippets about an album. I'd rather read, you know, like a page and a half written by an intelligent person who has something good to say about the album. I don't think that that's going away.
Well, maybe the argument that he was making was more about music discovery. And I've never really thought of Twitter as a music discovery tool. I've thought of it as a music promotion tool, and I think the two are different. When I'm trying to discover music, I'll go places where I can just listen to tracks really quick.
Yeah.
But as far as a music promotion tool, I've discovered music because of certain people's promotion efforts, which weren't necessarily buy my album, you know, just random messages saying that, but more, you know, people interacting with me and then saying something about, hey, would you check out a song of mine? And then I do. And I think that's different than talking about it being a discovery tool. But a lot of people are, one of the benefits of Twitter that a lot of people are really understanding, especially after this Iran situation going on right now where Twitter's front and center in the news, is that you can do, one of its usefulnesses is real-time searches on real trending topics. And in that conversation, or in his little presentation, the video, Christopher mentions, you know, that he's talking about being at that festival, and it's a festival where you go to ignore Phish because Phish is, you know, always there jamming and
right,
you know,
right.
But because it's a trending topic on Twitter, all the media is over there covering Phish when really nobody cares.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, I understand that right now it's in one of those stages where it's just coming on the mainstream and people are understanding how to use it. It'll die down. And
yeah.
But the real-time web, I think what's more important is in our next episode of the podcast, the interview I did, that'll be out a week after this one, also highlights this, that I think what the real trend is that everything's going to be moving to a real-time web where the information people want is like real-time information, not like I'm going online to read about what Chris Robley has been up to. You know, I want to go see real-time information, and more so with live performances, you know, Twitter updates and things like that. I think that's where a lot of the web's going. But if there was a couple quotes from the video, his little presentation that I thought was where it was interesting. He said, in reference to like trending topics and finding bands that are being talked about the most or whatever through Twitter, he said, it's not the music that is the best, but it's the music that people can stand.
That the so, most people can stand right?
Yeah. So, so I thought that was a good quote. And then Twitter makes it easy to find stuff that pertains to you. I want to learn about stuff that's not important to me. And I think that's where, you know, him being a journalist, obviously, like you were saying, Robert, some people could think he's just whining because he's losing his job. And a lot of people on various blogs where this little video clip got posted, a lot of people were saying that. But I understand the fact of how with the downfall of like magazines and then, you know, even some blogs that just can't keep up, there's kind of the loss of, I'm not going to come across anything that I wouldn't seek out on my own. And for most people, that means your horizon is going to be pretty narrow.
I think that there will always be tastemakers, and I think there will always be personalities that people want to read on all sorts of different subjects. I don't think that's going to go away. But yeah, I mean that, you know, writers, you know, especially professional writers right now are hitting hard times just like everybody else, but maybe perhaps more than everybody else. And yeah, like the first, you know, the easiest thing is probably to blame technology for it because it is changing so drastically, quickly.
Mm-hmm. I've got some more listeners chiming in on Twitter. We have, let's see, Chris Flew, that's his Twitter name. He said he's actually been pleasantly surprised at how little bands have tried to use it as a spamming tool, a la MySpace and others. And I think Twitter, the way it works, kind of, I don't know.
You can unfollow people.
You can unfollow people, so there's some sort of check and balance there that if people want followers, they just can't spam. And so there is, unlike MySpace, where you can unfriend people, but it's not easy. And, yeah, that's one of the benefits of Twitter. And, you know, I have seen some bands doing it very poorly and that usually have no followers. So then Bish Music, he also chimed in, love using Twitter, but the jury's still out for me on its usefulness for marketing my music, especially locally. And Darren Riley writes, he's named Poncho Ballard on Twitter. He's from the UK and makes his own guitar pedals, I found out. He wrote, my worry is that Twitter evolves too much. I don't want it to do many things, just this one thing really well. And that's kind of what I was thinking could be the downfall of Twitter with all this explosion of kind of becoming the real-time web. I think there's a real positive to that, but I could see it also destroying Twitter as a network and something else popping up that people gravitate towards. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it's weird how Twitter's changed a lot since we started talking about it on the podcast and I started using it. It's just like drastically what people are using it for is quite different, but it still has its usefulness. So any other comments, Chris?
No, I'm trying to think about the last thing I tweeted about. Oh, yeah, yesterday I was looking out the window at my house and for the second time in a month, someone spat on a car as it was walking by. So I tweeted about that.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't pertain to anything.
I don't think
anything.
I want to live in your neighborhood if people are spitting on cars.
It's bizarre.
It is bizarre. But the video, we'll put a link to the video we've been discussing by, it's Chris Weingarten at the 140 Characters Conference.
What is it? Something in the title about crowdsourcing?
Crowdsourcing.
What is that?
It's like outsourcing to a crowd, to like a sort of vague... them out there.
Okay.
So it's like saying, like, I've done it many times using Twitter. Anybody know a good blah, blah, blah that I can use for this?
Right.
You know, a good program or I got to do this. Anything you recommend? And so people that
so
just start
rather than
in,
rather than asking one really smart person, you just ask a whole bunch of dumb people and hope see what they all have
well,
to say.
Well, some people think that there's like wisdom in crowds and then other people react against that and think that you'll get a very diluted boring yeah. thing from crowds.
Somebody I know said the mass crowds would be better than trained employees.
Who could that be?
Yeah, so that's what crowdsourcing is, and the idea that you're asking the general populace about what band is good, and in this speech, what band is good, and getting response from them, and going on that response as opposed to maybe a select few that really know what they're talking about.
Right. It's like if you asked everybody what their favorite beer was, it would come back Budweiser. Well, maybe not in the Northwest.
If you ask someone in Portland.
Yeah,
somebody in Atlanta, it'll be Budweiser out of a can.
Yeah.
Portland, do they sell Budweiser in Portland?
I think just PBR.
That's right. Well, I think one example where I would disagree with Christopher's little speech is that here in town, the paper, the Oregonian, they've got their arts and entertainment section and they would have their movie reviews every week. And it got to the point when I would look at that if they loved a movie, I knew I would hate it. And if they hated a movie, everyone I knew liked it. And so it was just, I started wondering if they were just trying to just say what they knew everyone would like. I know people are going to like this. So I'm going to say I hate it. And it just came to the point where their review was meaningless. And
except
therefore,
that you knew what the opposite was, which meant
it was meaningful.
It was meaningful.
But then I also stopped reading it. So that means they lost my money. So, I mean, that to me, the point was, yeah, but at the same time, I had no respect for them. It was like I could have just been writing those because if you're going to set yourself up as a tastemaker, you also have to have some sort of, I don't know, respect for your audience and understand that you're not there to be the only person on the planet to like that and mm-hmm. be like, no
it
one else likes
it,
this yet.
It shouldn't be elitist. It
yeah,
should be,
and that's,
look what I discovered. You might like it because of these reasons.
Yeah, and that's where I felt in this situation, the movie reviews were very elitist and it was really just like, if they loved it, everyone I knew hated it. If they hated it, everyone I knew that saw it loved it. Mm-hmm. And it was this was a broad scope of people. This wasn't like, you know, the same kind of people, you know. So it was just odd that I noticed that. And it's like you just made yourself irrelevant. And so that's what I think most people like about the idea of Twitter is that those people that have set themselves up as, you know, maybe elitist have become irrelevant, and therefore I don't have to get their opinion.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the things. I think that that's why this this guy Christopher is threatened, not because of the crowds, but because of the ability for tastemakers to basically take his job. Like any, you know, I mean, there's always has to be tastemakers. Tastemakers aren't going to go away, but just because you're getting a paycheck, it doesn't matter whether you're getting a paycheck for being a tastemaker anymore. If you're a good tastemaker, people are going to follow you, and you're going to be a challenge to people who are getting a paycheck for not being as good a tastemaker as you.
Or as quick.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's also the thing. It's that Twitter is now. So yeah. You can chime in with something, and somebody will have that message being passed around all over the web before the traditional media even gets it. And that's part of the downfall of, you know, print media, because you can find it on the web far quicker than that monthly magazine. And then those websites are in trouble because you can find it on Twitter instantly, you know. Yeah. So why wait for those?
I mean,
others?
It's not gonna, I, you know, underground music, like bands that are taking risks, weird music, like that's never gonna go away. It's, and people are going to be, are able to find that stuff and enjoy it even easier now than they were when I was a kid, you know? I don't think that, you know, mediocre music does appeal to sort of the masses to a certain extent, but that it always has, you know? I mean, that's not, nothing about that is changing.
Well said. I think we covered it well. Let's move on. If you'd like to weigh in on the topic of this video that we're referencing, that again you can find in the show notes for this episode of the podcast at cdbabypodcast.com, you can leave a comment there on the podcast website or call our listener line, which is 206-426-5683. Or you can email us at info@cdbabypodcast.com. and speaking of the calls, let's get to your phone calls.
Podcast. Message line 206-426-5683.
The number you have dialed,
206-426-5683.
Hey guys, this is Jay Croft. I'm from State, Michigan. It's a suburb outside of Detroit. I just wanted to give you guys a call and tell you drummers out there, as a drummer myself, one important thing never to forget, and a big mistake I made over 5 years ago at a show: never forget to bring your drum rug. Never assume that the club or bar you're going to play at has a rug. There's some great options out there. There's ones that have blocks of wood attached to the front of it so your drums won't go sliding everywhere. I played a show in Detroit once, tile floor. They had a rug there, but it was just, you know, like a floor mat, and literally had to have my bass guitarist put a cinder block in front of the bass drum and put her foot on the cinder block the whole show because the drum would not stop moving. It can be quite embarrassing and be very difficult to play with a walking bass drum, so drummers out there, make sure that you never assume that there's going to be a good rug there for you to play on. You can check out the band that I used to be in as a drummer, Bedford Drive. They go on CDBaby or iTunes. Some great stuff. Check it out. And guys, keep it up. Love the show. Bye.
Hi. My name is Cassie MacDonald, and I'm calling from Halifax, Nova Scotia in Canada. And I thought I would share the story of how I experienced simultaneously the highest and lowest moments of my music career thus far. I was recording my EP in a studio in Halifax, and just about the time when we came up to the song I considered to be my most challenging song, and the song I had decided those 5 minutes earlier that I was going to try something new with, the owner of the studio said that a friend of his would be dropping by, a friend by the name of Daniel Lanois. For those of you who don't know that name, he is a singer-songwriter in his own right, but he also works with some of the biggest musicians in the world, such as U2, Bob Dylan, to name a couple. Anyway, I went into panic mode and went upstairs to the vocal booth, walked around in circles for a few minutes and said, I'm about to sing for Daniel Lemoine, I'm about to sing for Daniel Lemoine. Couldn't get myself together and blurted out the worst possible sound from a human vocal chord you could possibly imagine when I got to the chorus where I was trying the new thing. And anyway, I had the chance to sing for Daniel Lanois, and I sang like a screaming banshee. But afterwards, we all sat around and shared this single beer that Daniel happened to have inside his jacket pocket. And I actually got to live in the moment and just experience a conversation and a little bit of musical advice from one of the biggest music producers in the world. Thanks for listening. My name is Cassie. I front an indie folk pop band called The Dorothys, and you can actually find our EP Nightlights on CD Baby. Thanks. Have a good one.
Well, thanks for those calls.
I don't know if the lesson there is to not change the melody at the last minute or to not be nervous.
The thing I was most intrigued about that was like, what's Daniel Lanois doing walking around with a beer in his pocket?
He can do whatever he wants.
That's what I was kept wondering.
Keeping it mellow.
The other caller that forgot his drum rug, I played a gig about a month ago, and we had a show that was about an hour outside Portland. Cut their setup. The drummer realized he didn't have his hi-hat cymbals. He had the hi-hat holder, or whatever you call it, and the foot pedal and all that, but no cymbals. And it was we had to start soon. He didn't have time to drive back to Portland and then back out again. So we did the whole gig without hi-hat.
Oh, wow.
It was actually totally fine. Like, after the first song, I forgot and everything was going well. Like, he would just do rim shots or something instead. Or
you play a lot of ride?
Probably, yeah, favorite of cymbals. And then we played for about 2 hours. At the end of the set, we closed with a song that really needed the hi-hat. So I was like, oh, yeah. Well, you did all right for about an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, the other thing to remember, never to forget, which has happened to me a few times, is your drummer.
The whole drummer?
That's easy to do.
They often forget themselves. I know.
That's funny. Yeah, I've seen drummers playing where they're just being tortured by the fact that their kick drum just keeps moving out and out and out, and mm-hmm. not a whole lot you can do. So yeah, there's some... Never want to forget that, because nothing's worse than a gig where your gear's just crapping out the whole time. And just, but anyway, that story about Daniel Lanois showing up to the studio reminded me, not as big of a deal, but one time when I was in the studio recording, I turned around. Well, it was just me and the producer. We were recording guitar overdubs for our second Small Town Poets album. And somebody came in while I was in the middle of tracking. And after I finished that take, I turned around, and it was Robert Cray, who is a very talented blues guitar player in his own right.
Isn't he from Portland, right?
I don't know. I haven't heard his name here. But he was in Memphis recording at the same studio we were. And so it was a little intimidating to have somebody who's much more talented at guitar than you standing there, you know, waiting for you to finish your take. But I made it. And I highly doubt Robert cared one bit.
Yeah, he didn't brush you aside and say, no. Let me do it.
Oh, you've got an email there, Robert. Why don't we get to that?
Yes, I do. I have an email from Linda Wood, and she says, there has been a lot of talk about social networking sites and thinking in terms of being there for the fans, not the fans being there for us. And I think this is great, but as a female solo artist, I'm always getting hit on by men through social networking sites as well as at gigs. I try to be very circumspect in my communication and not send the wrong message, but it's actually quite tiring at times. In the old days, when you turned up, did your gig, and maybe signed a few CDs or whatever, then left because you were the star, people didn't expect so much of you. Now, it sometimes seems like you have to be everyone's friend. Quite frankly, at times, I really hate it, and I wonder if all this familiarity built around social networking is just too much. I'd really like to hear from other female solo artists who are gigging on their own and if they've found ways to deal with this phenomenon. I'm sure I'm not the only one.
That's not so much a problem with social media as it is a problem with men.
Yeah. But yeah. I think the problem with social media comes in where they feel like they know you a little better. And we've had someone write in the past that saying that they don't use Twitter as much because they don't want guys knowing, you know, I'm at my car, knowing I'm leaving the gig.
Right. Yeah. Right. And I think those are definitely things that, but I mean, my feeling is that as a performer, as someone who's putting yourself out in the world, who's trying to gain attention, that it comes with the territory. I mean, it's not fair that, you know, women have to put up with a certain kind of harassment that maybe men don't, but I don't see it as a symptom so much of social networking as just a symptom of fame, of, you know, putting yourself, of being a performer. And that doesn't mean it's not a pain.
Yeah. I think for a female, I mean, no one's hitting on me on Twitter, so I don't know. Plus, you know, if I was a female and a solo artist, I probably wouldn't say as much about where I am, especially like at the gig. You know, I'm out in the parking lot, heading out, leaving, you know, I'm by myself, and
right.
You know, I wouldn't say stuff like that.
Right. But, I mean, you can definitely, you can stick to just talking about music. You don't have to give out personal details, you know.
But we're just three guys, what do we know? So
exactly.
If you're a female artist, especially a solo artist, Linda from Australia would love your feedback. So you can do that by leaving a comment in the show notes for this edition of the podcast at cdbabypodcast.com. And Linda's a big fan of the podcast, so I'm sure she'll know that we read the email, and we'll let her know, and she'll be looking for those comments.
It's too bad she has to worry about that stuff, though. I mean, I'm sure it's a totally valid concern, but at the same time, at least she's being hit on. That's kind of flattering.
Yeah.
Sorry, Linda.
We're all a little bit jealous of your problems.
As we close out the show, I just wanted to say a couple things. One, I had a mistake story of myself that I'd share really quickly. You know, as you know, the band I'm in, Hello Morning, has been recording, and it was simple, it was quick, and boy, we're paying for it now, literally. We were in the studio and the engineer asked us, do you want to record at 44.1 or 96K? And we really hadn't thought through. It was just like on the spot decision. What do you suggest? And he said, well, it's not that huge of a difference, but he liked 96K. So we went with that. So all our plans to do some overdubbing and especially the editing of the tracks went out the window when we realized that would not work on any of our Pro Tools systems.
Oh, no.
And so
you can dumb them down.
You can, but it still takes time in the studio to do it well. Anyway, it was just one of those silly, stupid things that it's like, now we're paying for it because we can't do the editing. Mainly the editing is what I want to do at home. That stuff where it's like, okay, this guitar takes better than that one. Let's keep this one. Let's use this part here. And so now we got to do that in the studio in a situation where you feel a little more, you know, like you can't sit with your decision for, you know, kind of decide. So
it's tough to do playback with a lot of plugins on your tracks too at 96K.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the other thing. So I'm still making mistakes just like everyone else. But to close things out on the podcast, I was going to play a song that one of our listeners, Ryan States, he's contributed to the podcast several times through email and phone. He's our resident circus piano player. You remember he's called
Poop Bucket.
Yeah, the Poop Bucket. His descriptions of the circus are hilarious, and I keep telling him he needs to write a book because he's very good at writing that stuff. But he, since he's on a train writing a record, you know, he's on a train going to, you know, town to town with the circus. He's got a little studio on there and working on an album, and he has players play parts for him, and he just emails them the tracks and they play it and email him back. And he asked me to play some acoustic guitar on a track, and I did.
Cool.
And it was a cool experience. And the reason I bring it up is because there's a couple other companies that have popped up recently that are doing this kind of thing, that enabling, you know, this kind of cross collaboration. And there's been some for a while, but there's some that are doing it in a quick interface where it just happens in your browser. And so this kind of, you know, collaboration where I've never met Ryan in person, but
how'd you do it? How'd you record it?
Just at home on, you know, this mic that I'm talking into right now and my acoustic guitar into Pro Tools.
In Pro Tools. So what files did he give you?
He just gave me a master wave file he gave me two versions, one that had a piano part in there that he wanted the acoustic guitar to mimic, mm-hmm. and then one without that. And then I just tracked it all and sent the raw acoustic file back, guitar file back to him. And he dropped it in, and it sounds like we all recorded together. So it was just interesting. And I thought, I told Ryan, well, since we kind of met because of the podcast and you're a fan of the show, I'd end the podcast with his song. So it is called Immigrant.
I was stopped by the Texas State Patrol. Didn't like the sound on my radio. Guess he never heard a heat wave. Didn't like my shoes, didn't want to trade. I was told by a man of color that it's not good to be so soft. He didn't approve of the love I made. I was lost and he was saved. Sometimes feel like a fish out of water. At times forget I'm not from here. The spirit lost from a much larger world. Been waiting for like 5 years ago. Made a vow with my co-conspirator to immigrate up north together. Said we give up all our loves if we let another year get the best of us. Then we'd be where the dreamers go, losing ourselves in the world capital. Now he say he gonna make it in singer. He got another place with another singer. Ooh, sometimes feel like a fish out of water. Times forget I'm not from here. The spirit lost from a larger world. Been waiting for like 5 years ago. Gonna steal a ride if I need to. There isn't much that I would not do. I may love someone though it's not fair. But I still don't know if I'll ever get there. My job for my sanity. Wake up tomorrow, I'll be 70. But hey, it's just another year. By the way things look, I'll still be here. Oh, it can't be so. I belong, where can I go?
Been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.